All right, tonight we begin a study of Revelation chapter 6. And if you recall back in chapter 4, verse 1, John is looking up and he sees a door open into heaven. And he's invited to come up there. And then in chapter 5, we have the throne scene. And, well, it's a continuation of the throne scene. But in God's right hand is a scroll printed on front and back, and has seven seals on it. And they searched high and low to find somebody who's worthy to open the scrolls, take off the seals, and they found nobody until the Lamb, Jesus, the Lion of Judah. And John was upset that nobody could open it, but he was told by one of the elders that the Lion of Judah could do it, and that was Jesus. And last week we hypothesized that the scroll was the mystery of salvation, totally revealed for us, still a mystery to the Old Testament prophets, and was a mystery to the apostles until Pentecost, when the Holy Spirit revealed that mystery. And we looked at the scriptures where Paul talked about that. So now we're in chapter 6, and Jesus will open six of the seven seals in chapter 6. And then we'll find that in chapter 7 there is what many of the writers talk about as an interlude. We don't get to find the seventh seal open until chapter 8. So tonight we'll get six of the seven seals opened by Jesus. And there's an interesting little pattern, and that is when Jesus opens the first seal, remember those living creatures that we saw several chapters ago? He opens a seal, and one of the living creatures says, "Come." And I looked up in your footnote might say, not just "come," it might say, "come and see." So apparently there's some wonder about whether or not the word really is just "come" or "come and see." And I looked it up in the Berry Interlinear, and he has it in the Greek, "come and see." But anyway, there's this pattern. Jesus opens one seal, and one of the four living creatures says, "Come and see." Then he opens a second seal, and another living creature says, "Come and see." And each one of the four living creatures has something to do with that. Now, there's something else that we need to notice about this chapter that I find interesting, and that is verses 1 through 8 are a description of things that are going to happen on earth from heaven's point of view. And then in verse 9, for the rest of the chapter, what we have is a description of activities that are going on in heaven. So we have a scene change here. Verses 1 through 8 are things that are happening on earth from heaven's point of view. And then verses 9 through, 17? Yeah, verses 9 through 17 is describing the activities in heaven that's going on. So it's very interesting, and we're getting into the really heavy part of Revelation. I mean, it gets much, much, much deeper, but we're getting into the part that's pretty heavy. And there's some controversy and disagreement, as you would expect, about some of these things. So we'll go through the overheads first, and then whatever time we have left over, we'll try to go back and read through things. I didn't put everything that's in there. I mean, if I did that, I'd just put all 17 verses up there. So what I'm trying to do is be efficient with what we have. And we have the four horses. And the four horses are really not that hard to understand, I don't believe, because if you look at verse 8, what you realize there is we have an explanation of horses 2 and 3. It just tells us, well, actually probably horses 2, 3, and 4. It explains what those mean, so our speculation there is pretty well-founded, I believe, when we consider verse 8. Okay, so Jesus opens the first seal, and in chapter 6 we have the Lamb, which is Jesus, breaks six of the seven seals. And in verse 2, there's a white horse. A horse represents power, and white represents purity. And the rider has a bow, which indicates he's a warrior. and he's wearing a crown. And the crown, remember, there are two kinds of crowns. It's the Stephanos, Greek word for crown, which means a crown of victory, like the people who won the games would wear. So it's a crown of victory. And he went out conquering and to conquer. And I think what we're talking about here is Jesus. I don't know anybody else who logically would fit this. Jesus obviously overcame. He conquered death. He conquered sin. He conquered everything that he touched. And he's still conquering. And I think the writer probably symbolizes Jesus, who continues to make spiritual conquests every time somebody is baptized into his kingdom. Now, why would this be important to the readers of this letter? Well, they'll be continually reassured. Remember, they're suffering. In fact, some of them are being killed. They'll be continually reassured that the kingdom that they're in, the spiritual kingdom, really is the all-powerful kingdom, which is more powerful than any other kingdom that can be on earth. And that will be, they'll be reminded of that all the way through the book. And they need that, because literally, their life depends on it. So, I think we're talking about Jesus on the white horse. And he's conquering now. Every time somebody becomes a Christian, somebody has been added to his kingdom. All right, then there was a red horse. I think all the commentators agree that the red horse indicates blood, and blood comes from warfare. And I think that's supported by the comment that's made in verse 8, which we'll see when we get there. But blood is coming from war. Blood is very interesting. The word sword in this chapter occurs twice, and it's the two different words that we talked about, and I think that's meaningful. But the writer, it says, took peace from the earth, and men slew one another with the sword. And in this case, the word sword is I hope I pronounce it right, Machaira, which was the sword that the Roman infantry wore. What they had was a Machaira, a smaller thing that could fit in a sheath in your belt. It probably symbolizes warfare, conquests, and I think, given what's said later in the chapter, it is warfare within the Roman Empire. It could be conquest of the Roman army of other peoples as they enhance the empire, but it probably also includes the death of persecuted Christians. So keep in mind that we're talking about the sword there, this Machaira thing, that is the sword of the Roman infantry. A different word for sword is used a little bit later on, and it changes the meaning, possibly, of what it's talking about. Okay, now we come to verses 5 and 6, and we have the black horse. The black horse, you know, in our culture, but in almost all other cultures, when you go to a funeral, you wear black or something dark. It's a color of mourning and so forth. In this case, it's the color of mourning and grieving, but it's also a color of famine. And we wouldn't know that, except what we have here is a description of a day's wage and the basic elements of food. So the rider had scales, and he's using the scales to measure food. And if you look it up, probably your footnote has this. A denarius is a day's wage. It was 18 cents. And that's what you got for a day's work back then. It was equivalent to what we call 18 cents. Probably worth less than that now, given inflation. But a denarius was a day's wage, and it was used to buy food staples. And the staples that are mentioned there are wheat and barley. So he's talking about, well, let's read those verses. 5 and 6. He says I'm in the wrong chapter. Be good if I get in the right chapter. Chapter 6. Okay. And verse 5. And when he broke the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come and see." And I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand, obviously going to measure something. And I heard, as it were, a voice in the center of the four living creatures. We don't know who was speaking, but the voice came out of the center of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. So a quart is something that's close to a dry measure, that's roughly a quart. That's a liquid measure, but it's a dry measure. But that is a day's, that's the amount of food that's needed to feed one person. So what we have here is, think about this, if a guy has a family, wife and 3 children, he works all day long, he gets a denarius, 1 day's wage, and that 1 day's wage will buy him 1 serving of wheat or barley. Well, do you see the problem? Who's going to eat it? It's one serving. So who gets it? Well, if a person is alone, he's okay. He'll make it from one day to the other. If he's got a family, he's not going to be okay. And there are a lot of people who think that this is a reference to the fact that Christians were penalized in pagan Rome because they refused to do homage to the pagan idolatry and worship the emperor, and they would not recant their faith in Jesus Christ, and therefore they were not allowed to participate in the daily economy that's going on there. There is no indication that I could find that there was some kind of famine that ran throughout the empire. So I think when we're talking about a famine here, we're really talking about the difficulty of Christians to find food for themselves and for their families. So it indicates a scarcity of food, and it possibly symbolizes the financial oppression, this is documented, of Christians who refused to honor pagan gods and were therefore unable to buy food. Now there is this little reference here at the end of verse 6 that says, do not harm the oil and the wine. And no scholar knows with any confidence what that means. There are 2 possible interpretations. I don't know which one makes the most sense to me. I'll just tell you what people say. One of them is that they're talking about rich people. Rich people could afford the oil and the wine. Maybe that's the case. The other interpretation is that there was not a scarcity of oil and wine like there was of the wheat and the barley. Maybe that's true. But scholars are really baffled about what that means. There was, if you live back in that time, there must have been some reason why this was blatantly obvious. It's not obvious to me. I don't, anybody have any ideas about what that would mean? Seems to me if you don't have enough money to buy much wheat and barley, you also would not have enough money to buy oil and wine. And the oil that we're talking about here is usually the oil that's used to cook. So if you're going to use some kind of a oil to cook the wheat and the barley, that oil was probably the oil we're talking about here. So I don't know what it means, and nobody else knows what it means either, unless somebody, you all know what it means. If you do, I'll put it on my overhead for next week. Okay. Yeah. The verse 8 now helps us. And if you look, I really like the footnotes in the New American Standard. It tells us about this horse. In verse 8, it just says to me, it was an ashen horse. But if you look over in your footnotes, it says sickly pale in the New American Standard. So what we have here is an ashen or sickly pale horse, which is the color that somebody turns when they're dying. You know, if you've ever had the unfortunate experience of being with somebody who's near death, they do change colors and they begin to look ashen when death is about to happen. So it's a sickly, pale horse, and the scriptures leave no doubt about what that represents. It represents death. So this pale horse represents death, and death was given authority by the Lamb, and it was followed by Hades, which is, of course, is the realm of departed spirits. So after one dies, one goes to Hades. I mean, Jesus went to Hades. for 3 days, but his soul was not left there, if you recall that. So death was given authority by the Lamb to kill one-fourth. And well, what does one-fourth indicate? Well, one-fourth indicates it's a portion. So it's limited authority. So this is where the different sword comes in. Death was given authority by the Lamb to kill one-fourth, that's a limitation, of the earth. And I would take that to mean the known world, which was the Roman Empire, with the sword, but in this case, it was the Rome Fia. And if you remember, the Rome Fia was the big bludgeon-type weapon. And we'll talk about that one in just a minute. He was going to kill the known world, the Roman Empire, with the sword, which is the Rome Fia, with famine. Now, the sword, the killing with the sword came from, wasn't that verse 5? The red horse. And then the famine is described in verse 6, where the guy on the black horse has the scales. And then the New American Standard translates this next word as pestilence. But if you look up the Greek word, it comes from thanatos, which means death, according to Vine. So why they chose to translate that as pestilence instead of death, I don't know. And then also wild beasts. So if it's going to kill a fourth of the earth, then what that means is it's going to probably include more than Christians. A lot of people are going to die. And that makes sense when you see what happens here with this Rome Fia thing. Death will be more than Christians. Now, the word Rome Fia, when it occurs, remember that's the big bludgeon sword. When that occurs in Revelation, it occurs in chapter 1, verses 16, chapter 2, verses 12 and 16, and then again in chapter 19, verses 15 and 21. And in those passages, it always refers to the sword that comes out of Jesus' mouth. It doesn't refer to the sword that the Roman soldier carried. It refers to the sword of retribution that comes out of Jesus' mouth that he uses to kill the nations. So the nations in Revelation is always used to refer to those who reject Jesus and persecute Christians. You will see that as we go through the whole book. That's what it means. So it's possible that Revelation 6:8 then, in keeping with these other passages, symbolizes the Lamb's, Jesus' use of earthly forces to impose judgment on those who reject him. And I got that part from Homer Haley's book on Revelation, and it made sense to me. So I put it in there. So you know, as we look back through the Old Testament, that God used one nation to punish other nations. And then sometimes after he used one nation, he used nation A to punish nation B, then he would go back and punish nation A for the evil that it did on nation B. And it could be that that's what's going on here. And it could be that that's why we have two different words for the word sword. I don't know if I'm making that clear or not. Are y'all getting what I'm trying to explain on that? Okay. So it could be that what we have here is symbolically, Jesus is taking retribution on those who oppose him and who persecute Christians, and a bunch of people are dying, probably including the Christians, but also including other people. Because this word Rome Fia is always used when Jesus is taking vengeance on those who oppose him, which of course in this day was plenty. Okay, and by the way, that Rome Fia thing is always said to be coming out of Jesus' mouth. Okay, then we have verses 9 and 10. Verses 9 and 10 are where we see the Christian martyrs. This is the fifth seal that's been opened. And we have the Christian martyrs, and they were martyred for their testimony. And let's go ahead and read that, verses 9 and 10. We'll see who these people were. He broke the fifth seal, and I saw underneath the altar, going back to the Old Testament altar, the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they had maintained, and they cried out with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, wilt thou refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Okay, now that's another key phrase there, those who dwell on the earth. As we go through the rest of Revelation, what you're going to see is when it talks about those who dwell on the earth, they're always the evil men who reject God, who reject Jesus, who persecute Christians. Those who dwell on the earth. That's opposed to Christians who are seen as the servants of God. Sometimes they're referred to as the bondservants of God. And sometimes they're Christians who are already in heaven. And those who dwell on the earth are those who oppose Christ, who reject Christ, and who probably persecute Christians. Okay. Now they're crying out. They are martyrs. They have been killed because they refuse to recant their faith in Jesus, and they refuse to worship the emperor in pagan idolatry. And now they're crying out, when are we going to be avenged? We were killed unjustly. How much longer is it going to last until we get vengeance? And that motivated me to put in two scriptures that you all have heard of before. One of them is Romans 12:19. Actually, both of these are in Romans 12:19, because Romans 12:19, in that Paul quotes Deuteronomy 32:35, but it says, never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. Because vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Which is Paul paraphrasing what's said in Deuteronomy chapter 32. So, that's a human trait. We're mistreated. We want the wrong to be righted. And so did they. And theirs was the ultimate wrong, because they were slaughtered just because they wouldn't worship pagan idolatry, the emperor of Rome, and they would not recant their faith in Jesus Christ. And they want to know, how long is this going to go on? Well, the answer is not given immediately, but I think it's given later on in this chapter. 11, they were told to rest. And let's read verse 11, because it makes it very clear. And there was given to each of them a white robe. Why'd they get the white robe? Because they had overcome. They had overcome. It was given a white robe indicating purity. And they were told they should rest. Well, when does somebody rest? They rest when their work is finished. So their task, their spiritual task, had been completed. They were to rest for a little while longer. Now, we don't know how much is a little while longer. But until the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who were to be killed, even as they had been, should be completed also. Now, that is really interesting. Kind of a depressing thing for them. That's why they were told earlier that Jesus' spiritual kingdom was going to prevail, for sure. And that those who were martyrs were in heaven. But they wanted to know what else was going to happen. And what he's saying to them there is, fellow servants and your brethren were going to be killed, even as you had been killed, you who wanted vengeance, because what it meant was more Christians were going to die. Pretty sober. More Christians were going to die. But that's what it says in verse 11. So it says, you rest and wait until all those, your fellow brethren and Christians, have been killed, because more are coming to join you. That's somber, isn't it? I mean, that really is. Things are really bad, and they're going to get worse. But don't give up, because it really is worth it. Can we identify with that in this life? I mean, I can. I mean, fortunately, nobody said either you recant your faith in Christ or we're going to kill you. But, you know, sometimes life gets pretty hard. There are some ways that we suffer some crummy things. Okay, 12 through 14, we start getting into some controversial territory. And freely admit that. But when we read verses 12 through 14, without knowing what else prophets have said in the Old Testament, and even what Jesus said in the New Testament, we kind of jump to the conclusion that this must be talking about the end of the world. But it says that there's going to be a judgment scene coming. There's going to be a great earthquake. The sun it became black. The moon became like blood. Stars fell to the earth. The sky split apart like a scroll. Every mountain and island removed out of their place. And there are two possible interpretations of this that are common. One is it refers to the final judgment scene, that vengeance is going to be given to these people at the final judgment. Another one is that it refers to the judgment on the political empire that had killed the Christians, which means it's judgment on the Roman Empire. So, when you read that, it just reeks of a judgment day. Now, the question is, when does this judgment day occur? When the Roman Empire falls, or on the final day? So, let's read verses 12 through 14, and you see how there is a huge temptation and attraction to apply this to the final judgment. I looked when he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree cast its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind, and the sky was split apart like a scroll when it's rolled up, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. Sounds like the end. Okay. Now, let's look at something, though. Similar language was used in the Old Testament and the New Testament to predict the fall of political empires. Do you have an example of that? Well, I just happen to have three. Let's go to Isaiah. And what I did is give you the verses from which these descriptions came. Stars and constellations will not flash their light. The sun will be dark. The moon will not give light. The heavens will tremble. The earth will be shaken from its place. The world will be punished for its evil. What's that talking about? You find in Isaiah 13, verses 10 through 13, that's a prophecy concerning the fall of Babylon. It's not the end of time. It's the fall of Babylon. All right? What does Joel have to say? The day of the Lord. Well, that must be the judgment day. The day of the Lord is coming. There will be clouds, thick darkness, gloom. Fire will desolate the land. The earth quakes. The heavens tremble. The sun and moon grow dark. The stars lose their brightness. Must be the end of the world. No, it's Joel's prophecy about the fall of Jerusalem. Okay, and what about what Jesus had to say? The sun will be darkened. The moon will not give its light. Stars will fall from the sky. The powers of the heavens will be shaken. The Son of Man will come on the clouds with power and glory. Surely that's the end of the world. No, it's Jesus' prophecy in Matthew 24 about the fall of Jerusalem in AD 7. So there's a real attraction and temptation for us to assume that all these things are talking about the end of the world, and they're clearly not. I mean, the scriptures are crystal clear on these things, that we're talking about the fall of a political empire. So the language in Revelation 6, 12 through 14 is similar to the language used by Isaiah, by Joel, by Matthew to refer to the fall of political empires. So I conclude, you disagree, but I conclude that the verses in 12 through 14 probably refer to the predicted fall of the political empire of the day, which was the Roman Empire. Because the first one up there is predicting the fall of Babylon. The second one is predicting the fall of Jerusalem back in Old Testament days. And then the third one was Jesus predicting the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70 when the Roman army conquered it. So I think what he's doing in Revelation 6 is using it apocalyptic language the same way that the Old Testament prophets did. Remember, I've tried to make the case for you that John here really does fall easily into the class of prophets, like we've had back through the Old Testament. Somebody might disagree about that, and that's fine. Now, let's look at this, because this is where the scholars really disagree, and you already know which side I would come down on, but I at least want to be fair and give you both sides of it. In verses 12 through 17, We've already read verses 12 through 14. Now let's look at verses 15 through 17. It says, "And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the commanders, and the rich, and the strong, and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains." There's something interesting about this verse 15, and that is we go from the greatest to the smallest. Notice this again. We go from kings of the earth to the great men to the commanders, and that in Romans, in the Roman army, that was some these guys called chiliarchs, that were commanders of 1,000 men. And then we go to the rich, then we go to the strong, and then we go to the slave, then we go to the free man. And what they did was hide themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, "Fall on us. Hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne, God the Father, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand?" Okay, now there are two ways that scholars come down on that one. Interpretation one is that this refers to the second coming of Jesus and the final judgment day. And I can see how one would get that idea. Then there is interpretation two, and that is that it's the wrath imposed on and the downfall of the Roman Empire. And as you probably guessed, that's the one I would favor. Verses 15 through 17 tells us that men of all social classes, from kings on down to slaves, will hide in caves, wanting rocks and mountains to follow them to escape the wrath of God and the Lamb. And there are three other places in the Old Testament where it describes people who are being attacked, they're under assault, wishing that these same things would happen to them. I didn't put them up there just for the sake of time. But what they're trying to do is hide to escape the wrath of God and the Lamb. Now, I tend to think that it's not talking about the final judgment day for these two scriptures. It conflicts with New Testament teaching about the second coming. In 1 Corinthians 15:52, it says that when the coming occurs, it will occur in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. Now, does that give people time to go find a place to hide to try to escape judgment? Well, I don't think so. But also, it says the day of the Lord, Peter says in 2 Peter 3:10, the day of the Lord will come like a thief by surprise. Well, if it's going to come like a thief by surprise, is that going to give men time to try to find a place to hide to keep this from happening? And again, I would answer, no, it wouldn't. So there will not be time nor ability for men to hide to try to escape the wrath of God and the Lamb. Therefore, I would conclude, it seems logical to me, that verses 12 through 17 are probably predicting God's wrath against and the downfall of the Roman Empire. So that's the wrath against Rome in chapter 6, verses 12 through 17. And I told you that when we went back to verse 10, that they asked, when is vengeance going to happen to avenge our unfair deaths? And I think that question is answered at the end of the chapter here. That is God's response to them. Now, he still doesn't nail down exactly when that's going to happen. But I think, now will there be vengeance on final judgment day for these evil people? Well, of course there will. But I think what he's talking about here is the vengeance that's going to become on the destruction and the fall of the Roman Empire that was so evil and idolatrous and persecuted all these Christians. Now, we'll go back and read through the chapter because we've got a few minutes left, but does anybody want to comment about this? Disagree with it, find it illogical, give support for interpretation one where it totally refers to judgment day, or what have you? Anybody?
I think it's probably all talking in code, so the people that need to understand can understand, and the people that don't, like Romans, the Romans wouldn't know that it's talking about them.
The Romans would know?
Would not know.
Would not know.
Yeah.
So are you saying
like
you agree with interpretation too?
I agree, yeah.
Okay. Anybody want to argue for interpretation one? I mean, obviously, those who are going to be punished when the Roman Empire falls are going to be punished eternally on the final judgment day. There's no question about that. But I think what he's doing here is, as you mentioned, your wording was, he's talking in code. This is meant to reassure those who were wrongfully killed because of their refusal to recant. It's assuring them, yes, vengeance is going to happen. Your unfair death will be avenged. And it's going to be avenged when the people who are persecuting you are all going to fall. The Roman Empire is going to come to a bitter defeat. And it did. Quite a bit. Well, one bell has rung. I don't know. Anybody have anything to say? We go back and just look at some of the high notes of this. Let's look at verse 1. I saw the Lamb broke out the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a voice of thunder, "Come." And again, let me remind you that each one of the four living things, whatever those things were with the six wings, each one of those had a part after each seal was broken. Now, what did that look like to John? I don't know what that looked like to John. I mean, it's not like, you know, if you really have a scroll with seven seals on it and you break one seal, I mean, you still can't read what the scroll has to say because there's six more seals holding it together. So you got to remember, we're talking about a vision that he sees here, and it's obviously miraculous. It's obviously symbolic. So he breaks the first seal, and lo and behold, we see this image on the white horse, which appears to be Jesus, and the living creature says, "Come and see this." And all of a sudden, John sees this image on the white horse, and then Jesus breaks the second seal. Well, the scroll is still not open if we're going to be literal about it, because there's five more seals holding the thing together. But then the second living creature says, "Come and see." And John sees this. Now here we see this red horse. So it's all very fuzzy about how all this happened. But we have to realize we're going back to very symbolic stuff and apocalyptic language. Okay. We made it. Next week, we'll do chapter 7, and chapter 7 is what the scholars call an interlude. We've opened six seals. There's one more seal to open, and we don't open that one until we get to chapter 8. So, next week, we'll do the interlude.
Yeah,
and how do I turn this thing off? Oh, yeah, escape. Yes, sir.
Those that had been martyred, killed for the cause of Christ, are asking, you know, how long is it going to be?
Yes.
They're given this white robe. Now, if we lived back then and we started reading that, if I die, this is what I'm going to get.
Yes. Exactly right.
Yeah.